by chance we're crossing the same roads all at one time. Even if you say it coming, no time to play out gracefully. One thing I know for sure, there'll be no doubt when you see you are. Grass make the heaven the middle of it. Grass make the heaven the middle. We are grass make the middle of it. Right on schedule.
The secret truth. Through forgiveness we awaken, transforming information and knowledge into wisdom. And now our co-hosts, Charlotte Littlefield and George Butler.
Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Charlotte Littlefield is off tonight. I've got a really fine guest this evening, this first hour. Name is Farrell Montgomery. He's out originally out of Oregon, been in the Air Force, supported AWACS. Welcome to our program, Farrell Montgomery.
Glad to be with you, George.
I tell you what, you've tell our listening audience, I think this is the first time that we've had you on the air as a guest, a little bit about your background, where you come from, about your Air Force time in the Air Force and what you supported, was AWACS, things like that.
Oh, yes. Well, as you mentioned, I was raised in Oregon and joined the Air Force and for about 15 years. And of course, I served as AWACS, a maintenance technician, and did all kinds of stuff. I loved my years there. And then after about 15 years, I'd, you know, gotten out of the service and I've just been trying to pick up important, you know, good causes and things and getting involved trying to make the world a better place, you know.
Where all were you stationed in the Air Force? Overseas or what?
Oh, yes. Well, I spent a year in Korea, and then most of the, you know, after that was in and out of Tinker Air Force Base for about 14 years. You know, it's, of course, Oklahoma City. Spent 3 years in Japan, you know, was in and out of Puerto Rico a few times. Visited all kinds of places, you know, Alaska, Philippines, you know, England, Germany. Spent a couple different tours in Saudi Arabia. I sure enjoyed it.
Yeah, you really, and you had a lot of schooling along the way there while you were in the Air Force. What's like 60-plus schools you went to while you were, you know, learning how to support even better the AWACS and other radar jobs and so forth? Tell us about some of that.
Oh, well, there was a whole bunch of classes, you know, that was distributed amongst quite a few different schools. And, of course, back when it was open, I guess it was Langley Air Force Base back in Illinois, there, my first year in Korea, I was actually a liquid oxygen production specialist. And Langley Air Force Base is where I went to school for that. And then after that, I transferred into AWACS. And, of course, went back to Tinker Air Force Base. And then went to school in Biloxi, Mississippi for the basic electronics and the entry courses for AWACS and everything. And we learned just some of the basic systems. And then once we went back to Tinker, and we were working on the flight line, actually working on the equipment, we took more detailed courses on the different pieces of equipment, you know, like the multi-processing unit, the radar, high power, you know, voltage, the high voltage power supply, the digital communication network that was, you know, putting the different systems together. There was, you know, the waveguide system with all the, you know, there was all kinds of stuff. The antenna system, which was a phase array, and then, of course, there was the, you know, the, it was kind of a digital ranging, kind of a digital version of the radar, but it was actually just computer transponders and stuff. It was an interrogator system. And that was it was all neat stuff to learn and work on.
Yeah, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I sure loved it. And, anytime I see an AWACS or I drive by a base, but when there's AWACS out there, or even back in Oklahoma City, you know, driving by Tinker, look out of the flight line, I still feel like that's actually my home. And it's like the most comfortable place in the world for me to be is out on the flight line amongst those aircraft.
Right. We're going to be producing, and Farrell Montgomery is an associate producer of our Fukushima Solutions World Conference here that's going to be held next month. And just wanted to get some feedback from you, Farrell. Where were you? Can you remember where you were on that day nearly 3 years ago, March 11th, 2011, when that tsunami hit Japan and caused that nuclear reactor to go into overload and meltdown? Where were you at that time?
Wow. Let's see. I believe I was staying with a friend up in Manor, Texas, and everything. But I've been having a lot of things happening in my life also. So
did you start listening to the television reports first, or radio, or go on the internet? I know you've been on the internet quite active on the internet over the years. Did you start following what went on over there and sort of put your ear to the ground, finding out what was going on real time? Is that right?
Yeah, well, just about every day get, you know, a dozen, 20 different emails or something, and I got an email message that, you know, that things were happening in Japan, and so I jumped on YouTube, and then I also watched the news, you know, on television, but YouTube is, and also the different videos at the different news centers that I was able to access online. That's what, you know, gave me the initial footage and everything. But then the reactors, I was just astonished at, you know, I can't believe that these guys were in a tsunami zone and they didn't, you know, like have concrete structures and stuff that the backup generators were inside or whatever. I just couldn't, they were just sitting out there to be flooded and disabled. And, but anyway, that's getting into a whole bunch of other things.
Yeah, that was one of the problems there, wasn't it?
Yeah, I do think that there's so many, you know, so many problems. Instead of trying to point fingers on this whole thing, yes, I really think that we need to just look at things as they are and bring experts together and find viable solutions. We need to actually find out the facts of all different elements of this problem, find out its specific magnitude of the problems, you know, get the facts together on the table, and then we can come up with proper solutions. I'm starting to jump around in the subjects. Everything, I guess later in the conversation, perhaps you could dive into some of the more details.
Yeah, you know, like you were saying earlier, those generators were down in the basement of those reactor buildings. And so when the tsunami came in over that wall, that seawall, it flooded down into the basement and knocked those generators out. But I think the pumps were down there also. That's what was also key to them not being able to bring those things back on to start continue to cool those reactor piles, see?
Yes, now some of the reports that I read, the generators were actually sitting outside alongside the building.
Yeah.
There may have been generators, you know, inside concealed structures, but the ones that I saw were all sitting outside and everything. But, yeah, you see, this is some of the things we need to, you know, identify or something in our preliminary gatherings or something. But anyway, go ahead.
The generators were knocked out, okay? And also the pumps were knocked out. And they couldn't bring them up, so as a result, we went into meltdown immediately. Now, I believe they started melting down, 2 to 3 days after that, or within 24 hours to 48 hours? Is that what I've read over the years and gathered together?
Yeah, well, there's other reports that I've read where they had another backup system that was basically a battery-based, and they didn't have enough battery to last very long, so immediately they put out orders, you know, for batteries and things. And, of course, the shipping of the batteries did not have a very high priority because other high priority things were also happening, and so the batteries that they had on board ran out of power before they could get, you know, other batteries hooked up. But that was, you know, these are other details. In other words, even looking at the design of the reactors, I'm just flabbergasted as to, you know, if the engineers would even want to design the buildings, the structures this way. But that's another thing. You know, we're starting to, I keep finding myself wanting to point fingers, but pointing fingers is one of the last ways to actually finding a proper solution. Because a lot of times when you start pointing fingers, some of the talent and resources that you actually need to find an effective solution get shut down once you start pointing fingers. You know, when actually we really need everyone, you know, to jump on board to move towards an effective solution.
Right. In next month, March 22nd and 23rd, the first day, March 22nd, is going to be concentrating on the remediation of the site. What can we do now to try to stem that spewing forth of that radiation and stop it or curtail it to some degree? The second day, March 23rd, will be about health issues. Now, I think more of that thing, the second day probably will attract more interest because everyone has their health at risk here. What are your thoughts about the health issues here?
Well, okay, I think on the health issues, probably to start off, I'm hoping that some of the experts will actually give us an idea of you know, like on the first day, once we've actually identified the amount of contamination and everything and the rates at which it's being released into the environment, both in the air and the water, and how much is being locked up in the soil and all those other, you know, things, then the biological experts, then they can probably, and even the marine experts and stuff, can have a better grasp as to how to predict how the radiation will actually interact with the biosphere, you know, both in the water and the atmosphere and precipitation into the topsoils and then absorption into different types of, you know, different biological systems. And then, of course, how each of those systems will react. You know, like right now, there was a forecast, I guess a couple years ago, that it would take about 6 years at the rates predicted at that time for the northern Pacific to be permanently impacted, you know, where the larger life forms would start dying off and the northern Pacific would no longer support, you know, advanced life forms. Basically predicting that the northern Pacific, about the only things that could live in it would be, you know, diatom, plankton, algae and bacteria. And then, you know, maybe some small species and things, but any of the higher life forms would absorb so much radioactivity that they couldn't sustain themselves, they couldn't reproduce or anything, and they just become fertilizer on the bottom of the ocean. Now here, last October, November, December, it looks like we started seeing some of those signs happening along the west coast of the USA and everything. But a lot of that information, though looking dramatic and, you know, like it's happening, it's still hard to actually get specific numbers and, you know, to quantify exactly what is happening. And we really need solid numbers in order to do accurate predictions. Anyway, you see, we need experts to be able to be handling these things because just someone like myself browsing through the internet, looking at symptoms and trying to make a guess, we need specifics. This guessing, you can't get good solutions out of just guessing.
Yeah, we need facts, and we need people that can do research and compile some factual information so that we're not on this rumor mill. We can easily get drawn into a rumor mill like, oh, yeah, there's sea life all over the floor of the West Coast oceans, you know what I mean? And it's easy just to start repeating that, but it's harder to prove it sometimes. What do you think?
Well, it's true. And, of course, the fisheries, more stories I've been hearing is the fisheries. They put Geiger counters over the conveyor belts as the fish. And then, you know, like every 20th fish or something like that would jump the Geiger counter. But I guess they didn't consider the radiation high enough to separate those fish out from the rest. And instead, they just allowed those fish to go in and get processed and mixed up with the other fish and then canned and then sent out. Now, you see, that's, unless you know the actual numbers you're dealing with, things like that, you don't know whether or not that's a good or bad thing.
Well, you have to have this source, too, see, like, you know, was it someone on the assembly line there, or, I mean, on the processing line? You know, what were the readings and so forth. And a lot of times you'll get just stories that people will tell, you know. But we know there's been a tremendous amount of radiation released into the North Pacific. And there was some early scientific evidence 3 or 4 months after about tuna in the North Pacific there off the coast of Northern California and Oregon and Washington that would indicate that there were fish that were contaminated very early on. And but we don't know exactly if that's been carried on. Now, we know that the North Pacific is being inundated by more and more radioactive water because they're releasing maybe 400 tons of water a day from that plant. This is just ungodly to try to imagine, you know, the amounts of release of water and so forth. They have 1,000 tanks on site at Fukushima Daiichi. Just storing water that's containing radioactive materials. So it's getting more and more dangerous. And is it going to be able to be controlled, do you think, Farrell?
Oh, well, just these temporary storage tanks sitting on the surface. Here a couple months ago, I checked, and it was over 1,000 already. Man, they don't need much of a quake to compromise the seals on those tanks or something. And then if a big tank would just flat out burst those tanks, all of that radiation just sitting there splashing off into the ocean. Okay, no matter what the numbers are, no matter what the hypothesizing, let's see, I think there was an American carrier that was sent into the area to assist. You know, 3 years ago, shortly off, like just off the coast.
Well, yeah, it was within a week or so, a week or more. You know, it was there. The USS Ronald Reagan was there, and other ships. Yeah.
Right. Now, if it wasn't for all of a sudden members of the crew responding quickly to radiation exposure and other things like that. There would not be a lot of evidence indicating that these radiation levels going into the ocean were actually life-threateningly intense. I'm not sure how long on station they were, whether it was 2 or 3 months or 2 or 3 weeks or whatever. But they now have, well, I believe it's 20 members that have been severely exposed that are being tended up in Seattle at the time, and still 20 members is not a large number of the crew, and so I don't know if those are the ones whose life is threatened, or if they're just received mild exposure or not. That's other things. There's so many details to check into on this.
Well, right now we're seeing reports of at least 100 of the first responders are suffering from unexplained illnesses like cancer and leukemia, okay? And the numbers vary depending on the condition that they're in. There's a lawsuit, I believe, that of about 71 sailors against the federal government, and TEPCO, I believe, is involved in that. There was a release news release just recently through CBS, okay? And in that, they interviewed a lieutenant, okay, who had been experiencing some problems, okay? And Vic Carter, there was a lieutenant, Navy lieutenant from Maryland, who can no longer walk, okay? And many are joining into these lawsuits, this main lawsuit that I believe consists of at least 70 to 100 that are in different states of condition and illness, because they believe it's tied back to their exposure to the radiation plume off the coast of Japan while they were on the USS Ronald Reagan. John Apsley, Dr. Apsley out of Seattle area, is leading a team to administer to those vets, and he will be at the conference on March 22nd and 23rd. And we're also holding this conference not only we're on Indiegogo, IndieGogo.com. Go in there and put Fukushima up, and our site will come up. And we're not only raising money to cover our expenses on this conference, but anything over $4,000 is going to the sailors to help them get well up there in Washington. And John Apsley, Dr. Apsley, is going to administer those funds up there to help those sailors. So we'd like for everybody to turn out and come into the www.FukushimaSolution.com website and be generous in their giving so that we can have this thing done, this conference, and reaching out to these sailors up there who some are very gravely ill. So that's basically what Apsley is doing up there. And there's, like I said, the number that you hear between 70 to 100 now of ill, sailors, you know. But I think I think there's, about 5,000 sailors on those ships usually? It depends on the aircraft carrier. What's that?
The minimum ever, the minimum I've ever seen on an aircraft carrier that deployed was like a skeleton crew was around 2,400 people.
Okay.
And they can hold up, they can hold up to, 5,000 or 6,000 people.
Okay.
Deployment. But that's kind of cramped quarters. So generally it's between, 3,000 and 5,000 people on an aircraft carrier, depending on the mission on and things. So if it was, say there was 100 people that's exposed, or at least exposed to the point where their health was affected, and say there's 2,500 people on board, and that was, like 4% of the people, 1 in 25 individuals. Or not 4%, but 10% of the people. There's a lot of people, like the radio men and others that would never, at least the chances of them being exposed would be pretty slim. But then there's other people that do operations, like they run patrol boats, they handle, water desalination and things like that, that their duties leave them in a position where they would be exposed, if you're sending and receiving sorties, you work on the deck quite a bit.
Yeah, landing and takeoffs, the airdales, they call them airdales,
Right, yeah, so if this is an aircraft carrier, you're going to have a lot of people that work the upper decks and stuff that would, receive a large amount of exposure, especially from airborne. Radioactivity and things. So there's a lot of variables there that I've not had time to look into either.
Right. We have several sites off of our site. If you go in to FukushimaSolution.com and go to our main page there, you'll see a list of speakers that we have already lined up, and let me just read off some of those. Katrine Balinsky is a Russian girl that was grew up in the Chernobyl area and got exposed to radiation over there. She's a founder of the Institute of Advanced Natural Health Sciences. She'll be at our conference speaking and telling her experiences. She's also done a very deep study of Fukushima over the last nearly 3 years, and so she'll have something to say about that. Arnie and Maggie Gunnarsson, he is an engineer, and also along with his wife Maggie, she founded the Fairwinds Energy Education. It's a nonprofit organization, and they're out of the East Coast up there in Connecticut and educating people about the dangers of nuclear generation, power generation. Vladimir Wedelisky, he's a genetics expert out of Mobile, Alabama. He's also a pediatrician. His interest, he'll be there, will be children and the impact. But you know, one thing that talking to him, Vladimir, was that they always state the danger of radiation, but they have adults in mind. And Vladimir told me the other day they never, equate that danger to children because children are so much smaller. And, boy, they can be impacted, can't they, Farrell? A lot graver than adults.
Yes, well, a child, their metabolism is a lot higher. They're growing. I think, for example, thyroid, if they get radiation exposure, I think their child thyroid is much more vulnerable than an adult. Child's lungs, the intestines, the digestive tract. Also, a child's bones are growing a lot more, so they're much more susceptible to absorbing, strontium and things like that that could, over a long period of time, either create bone cancer or shut down, the growth of red blood cells in the bone marrow and other things. And their nervous systems haven't developed fully, of course. In other words, you can have radioactive particles or even dissolved, I believe, like cesium and plutonium, for example. I believe they're highly dissolvable in water. So it's not particles anymore, but you've actually got the ionic atoms floating around and can be acquired by the different chemical processes in the body. So you basically have just that radioactivity capable of, releasing its potential and affecting anywhere within most of the body, whereas like your lungs would pick up particulates, and a particulate would implant itself in the lung and then it would create a kind of a cyst around it where it was a zone, a kill zone around your particle, going to try to turn your flesh to jelly, and of course your body would respond to that, and eventually that would become cancerous or something if your body was not able to expel that particle, like a fine particle of dust or something.
Yeah. Yeah, I got you. Well, that's where Wedelisky can come in. He can testify about the impact on children. We've got Stephen Starr coming in from Columbia, Missouri. He's a senior scientist. He's a doctor of clinical laboratory science program, University of Missouri at Columbia. And he knows a lot about weapon systems and the the spread of nuclear materials, the density and the impact that they have and the level of radiation. That's his areas of expertise. We have Ben Fuchs coming in. He's Mr. Pharmaceutical, And so he's going to be quite informative. And then also Dr. John Apsley, he's out of Washington State, the Seattle area, and he's a physician, author of Naturopath, but also in regenerative medicine. He's heading up the team that's treating several of the sailors up there. We don't know how many. He can't really disclose who they are because of confidentialities. But Dr. John Astley is treating a number of sailors off the USS Ronald Reagan, and we're going to devote anything over 4,000 to his sailors and try to get them well. Then Dr. William Deagle, who has written a white paper on remediation of the site at Fukushima Daiichi, is going to be on with us too. And he'll either be presenting that paper in person or by Skype. Now, we have a number of these people that have obligated to a minimum of Skype coming in and connecting in, and then most of them right now are going to be here on stage with us. But there are certain individuals that it's just virtually impossible to get everybody in here at the same time, so several of these people will be Skyping in to take, that we can accept their, listen to their testimony and their speeches. Dr. Helen Caldicott out of Australia, the Sydney area, she's going to be touring Japan next month. We hope to have her on through a Skype connection and give us an update about her visits there during that March tour that she's got lined up. And that should prove to be very, very interesting. Like I said, Arnie and Maggie, they're always very interesting to talk to. We've got a former student, a nutrition man that's helping us, Colin Diggs. I should say, let's just list some of our people here that that are putting this on. What do you think?
You want to go? Well, sure.
Okay, let me start listing some. Of course, I'm George Butler. I'm a producer of this. David Barrow is a co-producer. The Young Americans for Liberty at UT Austin, they're hosting us out there, and then they're providing us a room and things like that. And boy, they've been just wonderful. Nick Verdon is the president of the Young Americans for Liberty at UT Austin. They have tendencies towards libertarianism at this particular site. David Urth, he's a moderator. We haven't confirmed he's we think we can get him in here, but David Urth out of Salt Lake City. Like I said, Colin Diggs, he has a bachelor's degree in nutrition from the Penn State University up there in Philadelphia. And then Farrell Montgomery, who I'm talking to now, is an associate producer of this. You were raised in Oregon's Cascade Mountains, and you like that physical sciences, electronics, computers. I'm reading right from our site now, signal processing. You served in the United States Air Force for 15 years as an AWACS radar technician. And from there, you've really widened your views, haven't you?
Well, if it's science, technology, physics, electronics, computers, if it's a remote image acquisition, remote sensing, and also I've been dabbled in, cognitive, logic and theory and everything. I just like technology.
Well, that's good. Well, anyway, we're going to have people like yourself, put on this and help produce this, and we're going to put together. It's beginning to come together. This Katrine Balinski is very interesting, and she's a get up and go gal. We're going to be recording "Light a Little Candle" soon and releasing that as a single to help raise the money. And it's a song that I wrote back in 1989, but we're going to have a choir sing that. And so we're going to, like you were saying, we're not going to point fingers at this, but we do need to establish some of the realities of what's really going on about the level of radiation is one of the primary things that we have to get down. I mean, what are the numbers out there, and people are so mixed up. I hear all kinds of things, don't you, Farrell?
Yes. Well, in the military there for a while, I was, put in charge of, I guess I was a shelter, supervisor or manager, for NBC, that's nuclear, biological, chemical, warfare agent shelter. And they taught us, basically all the different standard material on nuclear, biological and chemical agents. And under the nuclear, they gave us different exposure, radiation exposure levels, so that we could, take effective action and treatment for different people that have been exposed, to different quantities and everything. And that was generally in rads, rads of exposure, anything over 150 rads really started becoming a problem to anyone that was exposed. then okay, then now they're talking about, you know, deck rolls and Serbian or whatever. Anyway, so I went to try to translate, you know, okay, or convert, you know, okay, what is, you know, how is one scale compared to another scale compared to another, and found out there's like a half a dozen different scales, and, well,
it's rather complicated, isn't it? Yeah, it's complicated.
I was overwhelmed trying to come up with a translation to be able to relate to my training and everything. And I'm still at a loss as to what the numbers mean that I'm reading. And then in the news reports, they say, okay, they've got this amount of radiation being emitted by cesium. Okay, then they've got other radiation being emitted by strontium. You know, others emitted, you know, by plutonium, other, you know, vapors or something, and others. Anyway, I can understand that, you know, a radioisotope would emit, for example, gamma, perhaps at certain energy levels and things like that. But they're not telling us what we need to know. They're just giving these crazy numbers in a kind of an obscure environment. At least that's what I'm seeing. Maybe I'm just so out of touch anymore that they've... anyway, so...
Well, that's what when Steve we bring is the
experts
doing.
In, yeah. Yeah, when they bring the experts in, I'm so far from being an expert. Of course, I was a specialist years ago. You know, this is 15, 20 years ago. But that's what we need, is we need the experts to come in and actually convert these numbers to legitimate, real-world, you know, data that can be presented and can be worked with as far as identifying the specific threat to be able to come up with an effective, proper solution.
Right. Stephen Starr out of University of Missouri there can give us those numbers. He is an expert in this area. And so, boy, I tell you what, our listening audience out there, tune in. Come out to the university. We'll be in room 3.02 in Painter Hall. That's right northeast of the main building there at the University of Texas campus at Austin. So come on out and listen to Stephen Starr, and he'll tell you, give you some really good background and give you good numbers and tell you what the spread of radiation is all about. He's an authority on nuclear weapons and so forth. And also, you know, he can tell you about nuclear reactors cooking down and so forth. So that's just one of our speakers. We're trying to attract another individual from Moscow that wrote the book on the Chernobyl you know what I mean, meltdown and disaster over there. And he's going to give us some very, very good insight if we can bring him into this on a Skype connection from Moscow. His recent book is about 380 pages long, and it's going to knock your eyes out. But also this book about Bill Deagle, this white paper recently that he's put out, it's going to be good. Deagle has had all kinds of experience around nuclear sites and processing and government. He was in government for a number of years from a medical position and background. So he can tell us a lot about you know, his experiences. And he can, what we're getting down to is what I understand is regenerative medicine is actually medicine down on the cellular level, down to the cell. And when you have a exposure to radiation, it causes all kinds of cell damage and so forth, and the cells quit exchanging nutrients and exhausting their you know, material properly. And so that's what's going on in a, and also it causes organs to malfunction and everything else, you know. One of my friends said a major exposure can just start, your skin can just be burned so badly it'll start peeling off. There's some bad situations depending on the exposure, aren't there, Farrell?
Oh, yes, at extreme levels, you know, high-intensity exposures over short periods of time, the radiation actually just starts punching all kinds of holes in the cell walls until it you know, it'll actually turn the flesh to kind of a gelatin or jelly form, and then that's like when your skin will start falling off and everything. It's, oh, well. but that's incredibly high, and the rest of your body is just dead, you know. Basically what happens is your DNA is damaged to the point where it can no longer create the amino acids necessary to keep the cells functioning. So even though a person still may be alive and looking around on their feet, it's only a matter of minutes or hours before their cells use up those amino acids that have already been produced by the DNA. And then, of course, since the DNA are no longer functioning, as those cells start shutting down due to lack of amino acids needed for them to maintain their processes, then the rest of your body will just start shutting down. In other words, at those radiation levels, you're dead walking. And then, of course, the greater radiation levels, when the skin actually starts falling off of you, you can only remain conscious for just a few minutes or something. Anyway, those are extreme, like a thousand rads, per minute exposure or something. I mean, you can only live for 2 or 3 minutes.
Well, I tell you what, we're not only going to have a lecture hall that seats 216 people, but we're also going to be webcasting this at www.liveonlocation.tv. Again, that website would be www.liveonlocation.tv. In addition to not only streaming it there, we're going to be live streaming it with a Japanese translator also into Japan on the Hangout channel of the Google Hangout. And we'll give you further information on that. Our main site, of course, is www.fukushimasolution.com, and that's the site to go to get the updates as far as what we're doing. We do have people in our resource site that are putting out some really fine information. We have a gentleman out of Japan that's in Romania now, and he runs the Fukushima Diary. We have another gentleman, James Corbett, who has the Fukushima Update in Japan. He's married to a Japanese lady and lives over there. And then we have another gentleman, Peterman here, Peterson, I believe is the name, is locally, that's got another site, FukushimaUpdateReport.com. So those are all good sites to go to and get updates continually. But we do have posts that we're putting up all the time on our site. If you go to FukushimaSolution.com and scroll to the bottom, you'll see recent posts that I put up. And one of the posts there says the sailors sue TEPCO. I think this is several months old, this particular posting as far as time goes, but it's still relevant because it's continuing on. And I believe here we go. We have 71, I think, in this article, U.S. Navy crew sued TEPCO, and half have cancer from Fukushima is what they're stating. That's what they claim. And many of these people are in their 20s. They're in their 20s. They reported radiation sickness, and they're filing a lawsuit that's been filed. This thing came out in the end of last year. It's about 2 months old. And so they're seeing leukemia, testicular cancer, unremitting genealogical bleeding requiring transfusions and other intervention. So there's very, very serious people here with very, very serious. One man, his thyroid was out of whack, and that he lost up to 60, 70 pounds in 1 month and then gained it back the next month. Another lady had a menstrual cycle that lasted for 6 months at a time, and she cannot get pregnant. So she says it ruined me. So you have different, sailors there that we need to help with we're going to be helping them through the John Apsley, fund that we're going to contribute to out of these funds here that we're raising. And he's going to be, practicing and administering regenerative, medicine. And, VA right now, they're not even into to what John Apsley can do for these sailors. And so that's a problem, isn't it? The VA's been behind on some of these things. Have they not, Farrell?
Well, now the VA, anytime there's something like, you know, Agent Orange or Gulf War Syndrome, or, you know, depleted uranium exposure. Anytime there's something that's non-standard that comes up that the VA is having to deal with the troops, the VA, they don't even acknowledge it initially. And so there has to be a significant action come forth from a number of people before the VA, you know, will basically be forced to start to acknowledge it and deal with it. And so now that you've got these, you know, soldiers from USS Ronald Reagan that have been exposed, the VA, maybe hand it over to the VA, and the VA is not, you know, the VA is not prepared to handle these guys. So, of course, there's going to be that administrative delay, you know, before the VA will be forced to come up with a way of, you know, of handling them, of properly treating them and, you know, trying to come up with, you know, effective remedies. But unfortunately, it is a bureaucracy, and so there is this process that needs to be gone through.
Yeah, George Riley led a valiant fight and struggle against the VA to force them to acknowledge that the that for those Persian Gulf sicknesses were not a syndrome, but they were real diseases, so forth, that really had a mycoplasma base. And she led quite a valiant charge on that, and they tried to disgrace her and discredit her everything they could, every way they could. But George Riley led a very valiant fight on that, and for the vets. So you have people like her out here, and she was a veteran, Air Force nurse. And that's where she caught one of those diseases herself and had to treat herself, and that's when she got to the bottom line and began to understand that this stuff is real and it's not a syndrome. And she really did a wonderful job in helping the veterans. But today, there are more, reported to be more veterans dying from suicide than combat deaths since we've been in Afghanistan and Iraq and so forth. So we're seeing a large number of veterans impacted by these wars that are committing suicide. And we have all kinds of injuries, of course, you know, injured and vets that with broken limbs and, you know, so forth, prosthetics, limbs, substitutes. So what do you see that we can hope to try to attain here? What kind of goals, Farrell Montgomery, on this conference that we're holding next month? What do you perceive that we can do? And tell us what you would try to do on this, your part.
Okay. Well, if I was not given any more information, but I was suddenly I'm getting off track just a little bit here, but if I was suddenly given the order to go in and fix Fukushima, you know, like I was given a battalion of combat engineers or something, what I would do is I would invade Japan, cordon off, you know, the Fukushima area, extend the land out to sea for a while, and then I would build a series of rings. I'd drill a bunch of wells down into the ground, basically three rings of wells, an inner ring, a center ring, and an outer ring. Outer ring, I'd start sucking groundwater out of. The center ring, I'd pump concrete into. And then the inner ring, I'd pump water out of it also. And the reason, basically the purpose of this would be to build a concrete wall under the ground, you know, to isolate that region so that I wouldn't be getting groundwater flowing through it. And, of course, I've noticed that the Japanese are trying to do something similar to that with this a series of wells and an ice wall. They're trying to do the same thing with ice, I guess, freeze it. But I would want to do concrete so that once I got the area isolated, then I could actually go in like a big old mining operation and, of course, put remote, you know, sensors and manipulators on a bunch of heavy equipment and other kinds of equipment and go in and you know, build ramps up the side of the buildings to stabilize them and do everything necessary, basically, to start gaining access to and gaining control of the different elements and, you know, in the different buildings. stuff. And eventually, you know, like I believe the big thing now is removing the plutonium from this pool on the top of this building. And the big risk is that that pool itself may be compromised and the water would drain out and expose the plutonium elements. And the storage is like a big matrix or honeycomb system up there that might be partially damaged to extract the plutonium elements, gain control of them, so they can properly be handled and managed.
Right.
But if that water, if something happens like another little earthquake and that water starts draining out, then before they can remove those plutonium elements, then basically they'd number one, become exposed to air. And since the air cannot carry away the waste heat, you know, that's being produced by those plutonium elements, they'll start to heat up and eventually to the point where they'll start catching fire. And so you'll have basically plutonium fire that would produce a bunch of plutonium aerosol into the atmosphere. And I would suspect then that the radiation levels would be so extreme that the air would actually carry that current over a little bit of over the eastern coast of Russia, you know, over Alaska, Canada, the USA, and the precipitation would actually poison the topsoil of all these areas, just from, you know, just from the plutonium that was captured in the rainwater. Now, since that radiation would be confined to a much smaller mass, you know, instead of the water carrying it off to the ocean, that's a tremendous mass of water in the Northern Pacific. But the plutonium aerosolized, falling on the topsoil, just a top few inches of topsoil, you know, in the Northern Hemisphere, it seems to me it would totally destroy the entire biosphere of the Northern Hemisphere, you know, if this was allowed to go on for very long. And so basically this plutonium fire is the worst thing imaginable that can happen. And the Japanese, from what I've been reading, are being incredibly careful to gain control of this material and remove it from that fragile environment before some kind of an accident happens.
Right.
I started this thing. But anyway, I guess from what I've been reading, it looks like some of those materials have fallen into a pile on the floor of the reactor, melted through the concrete, and form kind of a pool of molten magma with this radioactive material.
Well, what they call that is the corium, or the fuel-containing material, or a lava-like fuel-containing material. It's a lava-like molten mixture of portions of nuclear reactor core during the nuclear meltdown, and it's the most severe class of a nuclear reactor accident. Consists of nuclear fuel, fission products, control rods, and structural materials from around there, like molten concrete. So it right now it's been melted into this this lava-like molten mixture of these things, and that's what they can't get their handle on. This stuff is highly dangerous, and you can't even get close to it. And then how do you remove that with remote control devices? I guess, right? So it's a hellacious problem, and it just doesn't go away. It's the radioactive material is there giving out radiation.
Well, okay, the way I'm seeing it is, okay, there's no way of stopping the radioactive emissions of steam and things like that.
Right.
Now, if I was, you know, so that's, we're going to have to, there's no way of having a short-term solution. So we're going to have to do that over a long-term solution. And then stepping back to this wall of concrete in the ground, and then using heavy equipment or whatever is necessary to go in and gain control of the stuff above the ground. Once the stuff above the ground has been maintained, then you start to destroy the buildings, you know, remove the buildings, into sort them into different piles, different landfills, you know, where each landfill handles a different grade of contaminated product. And so the buildings are basically leveled, and then you start treating the whole thing as if it's, you know, like a copper mine or gold mine or diamond mine or something. You just start digging the ground out and chasing that molten magma down into the ground. But of course, since this concrete wall in my imaginary thing scenario has been created, and then now you have control of the groundwater inside the wall, of course, suck that water out so that everything inside the wall is dry. Because, you know, the purpose of that is so that that molten magma, you know, the radioactive nuclear core magma, as it sinks into the ground, instead of interacting with groundwater and creating radioactive steam and things, and creating foam and whatever, instead you have dry ground for that to further sink into and melt. So it mixes more and more with dry rock, and it increases the size of the molten mass, which dilutes the radioactivity to the point where it doesn't heat up so much. And so the theory there is to allow it to continue to sink into the ground and melt and melt and dispense itself and get a larger and larger magma pool to the point where the radioactive fission shuts down or it reaches a neutral area. And then the mining operations from above, when they reach that, the theory is that it will become a big chunk of molten glass, or not even molten glass, that it'll start to solidify as the heat dissipates. And then you can break those glass chunks up and then take them out and process them, you know, however is necessary. But the important thing is that you allow the radioactive materials to melt product, mix in with that molten product, and then dissipate the radiation.
Right.
At least that's the theory. But there's also problems because the plutonium and uranium, they have melting points that's different than the silicates and other materials that they'll be sinking down into. So one element is they may actually create cracks and fissures and things where the materials actually want to gas off, the vapors propagate through the fissures and then redeposit. You know, kind of like you get, like in gold mines and lead mines and stuff like that, you get little fingers of the metals dispersed throughout the rock. But still, the fact that they're dispersed is a good thing.
I see.
So once you mine the territory, remove all of the radioactive material and process it as you would any kind of ore, then you can gain control of that, materials and move them from the environment.
Okay, well, we're about at the end of the program, and I want to thank you very much, Farrell Montgomery Cup, for being with me this evening. And I tell you what, you've got some good ideas, and this is what this conference on March 22nd and 23rd at the university is going to spawn. We're going to get out there and debate these issues and put on the table any and all ideas, just like Farrell Montgomery did this evening. But thank you very much, Farrell, and we certainly appreciate you being with us this evening and helping on this conference.
Now, you're welcome, George.
Okay, good night.